The Bizarre Cast contains adult themes and explicit content. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a much anticipated episode of The Bizarre Cast. It's been a while, and I do have a recurring guest, Jude S. Walco, and he's back from the dead. Not the dead. The podcast is back from the dead, but Jude is here with me. Jude, how have you been?
Awesome. Thank you for having me. I am so honored to be on the revival episode of the podcast. It's awesome. Well,
it was on cold storage. It wasn't...
it was taking quite a COVID hiatus.
It was. lots happening between jobs and everything. Sure. Not that I was out of work, but... I'm not even used to talking myself now. I'm all jumbled up. So, Jude, for those who haven't been tuning in the last 70-plus episodes... Would you like to remind them a little bit of who you are and where you're coming from?
Absolutely. Right now I'm sitting in Thailand, which is one of the most beautiful places on earth. I have a wife and kids here. But my background is I'm an American, as most people can tell by my accent. I am a film producer by trade. That's what I mainly do. I've acted in probably, 50 films or so. And in the last few years, I've started doing more directing. So I've directed a few feature films. And then recently, last year, actually during the pandemic mostly, I wrote a novel, a horror novel called The Unhallowed Horseman, which is a contemporary reimagining of Sleepy Hollow characters from Washington Irving that was originally published in 1820. So I gave it a modern spin. And so I'm a producer, actor, writer, creative, general type person, I'd say.
A polymath. Yeah, you're quite good at everything. I've seen the movie the last time, The Incantation.
Yeah.
That was good fun. Yeah. Starring Dean Cain. Some of you out there might know him.
I was just gonna say that you know, since I've talked to you, all the behind the scenes of Incantation are on YouTube now. So they're not official, like edited. They are edited, but they're just stuff off our phones and stuff. So it's just crazy ramblings, but it's kind of fun to watch. So if any of your listeners want to watch behind the scenes before or after watching the movie, they can do it for free on YouTube. It's all, they can just look up my channel, Hobro, H-O-B-R-O, or just The Incantation behind the scenes and watch all that fun stuff. We shot it in France, exclusively in France. So it's a lot of fun to see, especially if you're not from there, in castles and stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely. I'll add the link in the show notes for that one for easy access.
All right.
And yeah, because the last time we spoke, you did mention that The Unhallowed Horseman was floating around as a screenplay, and I had forgotten about that because I only recently re-listened to our chat, and I said, while I was reading it, I said, God, this really reads as a screenplay, and I haven't read many screenplays, but I was like, God, this would be perfect for a TV show, so we can kind of... I touch on that in a little bit, but there's still a little bit more to discuss because we have about 4 years to catch up on it.
There's
been a pandemic in between.
There has been.
So everyone's still trying to get to grips with that a small bit. Yeah. And the last time we spoke, I was mere weeks away from actually traveling through Southeast Asia. Missed you in Bangkok.
right. Oh, it's too bad, man.
So good, great spot over in Thailand. Yeah. I'm kind of jealous.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, so you're there half the year, and then you fly in and out to the States for working on films.
Yeah. It's primarily the States because I spent a good portion of my life in Los Angeles. I grew up in Georgia. I graduated University of Georgia. I'm a bulldog. But I spent a lot of time because of my career in LA. So it's kind of my base of operations for work. But however, you know, in the film business, we have film incentives. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but they take us to wherever the money is, basically, when governments give, you know, tax breaks to film producers. Yeah. So these days in the States, you know, you can shoot, you know, Louisiana, Georgia is a big one. New Mexico, New York has one. And then other countries around the world have their own incentives, so they're battling for locations as well. So, but basically, I spend half my time with my family in Thailand, and then the rest working on films all over the world, but primarily the United States. I would say, 70% of the time is probably in the States.
Super. And we're going to talk, I suppose, primarily today about the Unhallowed Horseman. But before we press record, you did mention another project. Are we allowed to talk about that today?
Yeah, absolutely. The one I worked on. And
yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So that show, so when the this was crazy, actually. So when the pandemic started, right in March of 2020, I believe it was. So get this. I was in Thailand, right? So I'm getting news from China, where this shit is starting to open up in China, right? So this is very localized South Asian.
Yeah, close Asian, proximity there,
right?
Definitely.
So people, and you know, there's a huge contingent of Chinese tourists in Thailand, so they're all over the place. So we start seeing news about outbreaks and, you know, the same kind of thing you remember when Ebola and SARS broke out. So you're not really worried at that point. You're like, oh yeah, this is just another localized thing. So then it starts getting bigger and bigger and bigger. In the meantime, I line up this job with Netflix in Atlanta, Georgia, which is home of the whatever they call it, the CDC, I think. The Center for Disease Control is in Atlanta for America, is in Atlanta, Georgia. So it's like ground zero.
So The Walking Dead wasn't lying when they had that there.
Did you know that they did a pamphlet? I'll send it to you. It's hilarious. Where they actually did what to do in case of a zombie outbreak. Because it's basically a survival preparedness thing.
Get people interested.
Yeah, get them interested. But anyway, so... So I'm chasing it. I'm literally chasing it in front of it. You know, I get this job. I get on a plane. I leave my family in Thailand going, you know, good luck with the zombie apocalypse because I got to go take this job. I hope it doesn't creep into Thailand. You know, next thing I know, I'm in Atlanta and it's becoming global. At that time, it's hitting the western seaboard of the States because that's, you know, all the hubs of San Francisco and LA are major ports. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. Cut to... We're shooting a series. We're shooting a prank series with Gaten Matarazzo, who's from many of your fans will know him from Stranger Things. He plays the kid that has a lisp problem. He has a degenerative bone issue in real life, so he has a lisp. But he's one of the most endearing characters. He's the super cute kid with the curly hair and the baseball cap. Anyway, he is the host of this prank show. It's called Prank Encounters. It's on Netflix. You can check it out there. I think they've done maybe four seasons now, I think, or maybe just two. I can't remember. But it's the premise is basically we cast people. So we will cast people like, hey, you want to get a temp job working in this office or doing extra or taking a census or doing XYZ and pay them like $50 every couple weeks or, you know, a couple times a week. So they think they've got a normal temp job. The fact is that they are actually marks, as we call them, for this prank show. So they get strung along for as long as we can keep them, maybe 2-3 months prior to their engagement. In the meantime, we have a full-on production staff creating these hilarious, insane scenarios like aliens have landed on this swamp or Bigfoot's attacking this national park ranger station or whatever kind of crazy situation that is unbelievable. Or someone just got thrown off a balcony and murdered at the pool party. What are we going to do? Right. So these kind of situations. And so they're unknowing. And of course, casting, you know, they strategically ask these people questions and get the right kind of person that's going to react to this. They know. And that's kind of, you know, not really paying attention to particulars so that they'll get away with it. So then what happens is we build up this insane scenario. It takes place over a couple of hours. So we've had the police called on us, all kinds of things. But basically you put this person in this crazy situation to the point of they're either ready to beat the hell out of you, run for their lives, shit their pants, or a combination of any of those above, right? So at that point when it's all the way tilted to where something dangerous is going to, like this person's either going to hurt themselves or someone else.
Yeah.
Gaten jumps in and he goes, hi guys. Hey, it's me. Hey, it's Gaten. And he says, you're on my prank show. Yay. You know, and then still though, they're traumatized because most of them, I would say 85% of them believe this was an actual real fucking, as crazy as it was, this is a real thing happening. And then, you know, he soothes it over with them and they go home and a couple of them file lawsuits and a couple of them call the cops, but most of them are super happy to meet him because they're Stranger Things fans and it all ends well, but not always. So it's a funny show. But so I was working on that in the middle of the pandemic. We shut down once. The Atlanta mayor, I forget her name, she's a woman, African-American woman, I can't remember her name, she puts a curfew in Atlanta. All that's going down. The CDC doesn't know what to tell anybody at that point. It's literally, people are like, shit, this is like a zombie apocalypse. We all remember how it felt at that early stages on. And we were literally, we shut down the show. We were trying to get rid of stuff, pack it up, you know, hazmat suit spraying everything. 3 months later in July, we come back and start up again with, you know, we're winging it because nobody knows at that point. So we're doing the tests and blah, blah, blah. It was insane. So eventually we got it done. We ended up shooting, I think we're supposed to shoot 9 episodes. We shot 7. And what we got it in the can, and that's the last season that's on right now on Netflix is the one I was co-producing on. So yeah, that's what I was doing in my pandemic. And then I came back to Thailand and was like, fuck that. I'm going to sit tight for a while and not go anywhere. And I've been here ever since.
Nice. Yeah. I was role playing early Australia being a prisoner down here for two years. We weren't allowed leave.
Oh my God. Crazy.
So that was good fun. But we made the most of it.
And you're there, so you must have liked it.
Yeah, still there. No, it's good. Well, I couldn't leave up until a few months ago.
Oh God, that's insane. Well, it was founded as a debtor's colony, right? So they're just going back to their old ways.
Yeah, no, of course. So that sounds quite interesting. So how long were you stuck in Atlanta?
Oh, I was there till, I want to say September. I think we finished, you know, we did our second wave in July. I was stuck there till September. Luckily, I'm from Georgia, so I have family that's like 3 hours north of there. So that wasn't too bad. I could go back and see my family occasionally when I wasn't working. And then finally, it felt like an eternity. In late September, I got back to Thailand. But of course, at that time, it was still, you know, very bad. So I had to get all kinds of, you know, paperwork out the yin yang, all the tests and doctor's notes and special visas and, you know, contingent on XYZ. We can kick your ass back out of the country, all that stuff.
It's been a nightmare.
Yeah, it was a nightmare. But I got back in and I dug my heels in and I'm not leaving until the next work comes up. But
speaking of nightmares then and horror, when did you put pen to paper for the novelization of the screenplay of The Unhallowed Horseman?
Oh, the screenplay. Okay, so that was prior. So
we know that information from 4 years ago that it was a screenplay. So yes. when did it go from screenplay to novelization?
Okay, gotcha. That was after I came back. So that was in the late fall of 2020. Okay. The late fall of 2020, between that September and let's say January, I was doing the actual writing. I started off slow. I mean, every writer's different. I started off slow, like maybe under 1,000 words a day. And then I got up to anywhere between 1,200 and 1,500 words a day of what I considered quality writing. And it was great because I had had the script, as you said, for a long time, since like 2000, I don't know, 10, 11 or 12, somewhere around there. I can't even remember. So I had the story in my head, and I had done several revisions of this story since then. So it was kind of more polished. So it was already a really good blueprint for me to write a novel. And I had always like, you know, and screenplays are great for visceral stuff for you know, watching on the screen, but you don't get to tell the whole story because you have a very limited time. So you can't do exposition. It's boring to the audience. You can't give the characters dimension other than a few little nuggets there, here and there. So I was excited to write the novel because I kind of had this whole world building and, you know, these characters in my head for a long time. And for me, since I started, you know, young as an actor, characters are a big thing for me. They're like the hugest thing for me because, you know, I was trained actually by this guy named John Ammerman, who was a real Shakespeare aficionado, whatever they call them, like a Shakespeare actor certified by the Globe Theater Company. Anyway, he taught me, you know, about backstories and creating worlds for characters, even if you're doing a little small role to, you know, you're a truck driver in a bar, you still could have a backstory. No one's going to stop you from doing that. It makes it more appealing to the audience and more believable. So I always had that mindset about characters. And what I've always said about both script writing and coincidentally novel writing, is that I build these characters, their histories and their worlds. So they're individuals, like, and then they're based on the thousands of tens of thousands of people I've met in my life. I'm always observing as an actor individuals. And I know from being a line producer and production manager, there's certain types of individuals in the world. Like, I can sort of put people in, you know, is this guy an overachiever? Is this guy, you know, an instigator? Is this guy wants everyone to be happy, whatever, that kind of thing. So I know personality types, basically what I'm saying. So then
I'm really
channeling
my Goldfinger in this lighting here and the bald head.
Ah, it looks good, man. Looks
all,
good.
All I'm missing is a cat.
Yeah. My pretties. So I put my characters in a situation, right? I always give this example, like, let's say, you know, I have five of my characters and somebody walks in the door with a gun. How are they gonna react? So you can imagine any characters you want. You could put Goldfinger in there. You could put Donald Trump in there. You could put whoever, you know, Gilbert Godfrey just died, whoever, Naomi Judd, put them in a room and somebody walks in the gun. They're each gonna react differently to how that person and to each other, right? So that's kind of how the script goes for me. So I have the, you know, I already have the story arc thought out and I have certain subplots I wanna hit, but the real creative writing happens when these characters are introduced to some situation. And screenwriting, along with novel writing, although it's easier said than done, believe me, you got to keep the audience interested. If you're just writing to get word count or you're just writing to get to the next thing, that space in between, and you're going to lose your audience and they're bored. You know, they want constant engagement. So, and that's hard for anyone to do, even the greatest. You know, I just finished Ozarks. I won't give any plot spoilers, but that's probably, you know, that Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul are probably the best TV shows in the last 10 and decade. But they still have those times when they lull, when you're like, what the fuck? You look at your watch and you're like, okay, I get it. Let's go on to the next thing. And that's just, you know, our nature as an audience. And these days with, you know, constant... you know, content, we are even more ADHD, which is funny.
Well, you got me cover to cover. I did read it all.
Oh, thank you. That's an honor, man. That's an honor.
And I did read The Legend of Sleepy Hollow as a precursor, because I never read that.
That's great.
So I was doing my crash course on
good.
Sleepy Hollow, or Tarrytown, as it was previously known.
Yeah.
So before we dive into the contents, because I know you're spinning the yarns of how you tell a great story, that would be me to judge now with you.
Okay.
So how did, because you, as we spoke before, and you have in the author notes and everything like that, you're more kind of a scholar of Gothic American writing to an extent. And you're a big fan of Washington Irving to the extent that you borrowed the universe off him, if you'd allow me to say that.
Absolutely. Absolutely did.
So what's your history with Washington Irving, and why does, in particular, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow resonate with you so much? Because just for me beforehand, I always feel when I go back to read historical works, because I recently this year as well read Frankenstein
for the first time,
and it feels as if you're reading a story you've heard 1,000 times, because you have, and it was the first one. So yes. I felt The Legend of Sleepy Hollow really suffered for me, as every single New England rustic Halloween-y, you know, orange and brown.
Right.
That is the book. But I was like, I know this one.
Right.
Because I've seen it countless times, you know, exactly. Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
X, Y, and Z. What was that? Spot the dog. No, there was this other dog. What was that? What was the story dog? Doesn't matter.
Blue's Clues.
It was some sort of dog who used to dress up and do different, like, tails. Do you remember
that? Oh, I don't know which one that was. No.
Oh, anyway, I can't remember.
I know Scooby-Doo, who's huge.
Yeah, he probably does the Sleepy Hollow as well. So it was like, oh, I know the story. So I was like, how are you going to, like, cap this one off? Because it's actually such a legendary
absolutely.
Book. So to go back to the question, I suppose, how did you get acquainted with this, and why did you decide...
Okay.
To borrow heavily from it.
Okay, I got you. So, you know, a lot of Americans will say this. It's become an American icon, this particular character of the Headless Horseman. You know, like, you know, we have Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny, and the Headless Horseman, and especially in the last decade, has been a huge iconic character in the Halloween period, right? You got the classics, like you said, Frankenstein, Dracula, Swamp Thing, Mummy, and now Headless Horseman has made his way into that crew. So when I was young, and I say that because a lot of Americans have a similar experience with this particular story. It's the kind of safe story, the original one by Washington Irving, that every kid can watch on Halloween. Disney did a couple versions of it. There's been, like you said, a million cartoons of it, Scooby-Doo, all those things. But as a kid, it's like for me at least, it was the first, it's the first time that it was sort of edgy, you know, even as a young kid, like this is, it's sort of horror, but those versions, even in the real Sleepy Hollow, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow by Washington Irving, is not really that scary. It's more like a prank that they pull on Ichabod Crane. You know, it's not, there's no proof that anyone dies. It's kind of alluded that.
Very short as well. I wasn't expecting it.
Super short, right. So it's kind of alluded to that he either left town because he was a chicken shit, or maybe the horseman got him. That the question mark in the end is the whole thing that's appealing. Yeah. But as a young kid, you know, I love this story, and it was sort of a beginning of my opening into this whole world. So then as I grew up, I went to the seminary, and very gothic type seminaries, old 100, 150 year old schools with gargoyles, and you know, they look like Harry Potter stuff. So that sort of aesthetic has been a part of my youth forever. So I was raised in that sort of gothic, sort of borderline horror world. My brother was 10 years older than me. I've said this stuff before, but he sort of influenced me because he was into stuff that was 10 years age inappropriate for me. So I was way ahead of the curve as far as horror, rock and roll, pop culture, because I was just feeding off of whatever he was into, right? So I'm obsessed with that character from childhood. Then in October, I'm not sure, I do say it in the book, I can't remember though, it was probably 2010 or 2008, somewhere around, I don't know. I was stuck in a little small town called Monterey Park out in the suburbs of LA. It's predominantly Chinese, very quiet town, just elderly people. And it was Halloween. And I was stuck in this house that had no power half the time, and I was lighting candlelight, and I was like, man, I'm really feeling the vibe of Halloween. And I love classic literature, and that was one of my favorite stories. So I go to the library, that's my Southern coming out, library. I check out the works of Washington Irving, which was like a 900-page book, you know, and I bring it over to this little thing and read it by candlelight during Halloween. And that's where the spark for the story happened. You know, that's where the spark for the script happened. I was also at that time, you know, I wanted to direct my own movie. I wanted to push myself as a creative because I had been working as a producer for decades, and I was ready to switch gears into the creative mode. So it was a culmination of everything coming to a point. And that's how the spark started. I guess. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Because reading the book, it was definitely very entertaining. And as I did mention, it really felt like it could be planted straight into the screen. Like you really did paint a picture very well of all the scenes that I was like, this could be a Netflix show. This could be, you know, all those teen sort of horror shows like Scream or Riverdale or something like that. It would fit in like perfect to that.
Exactly.
And the fact you've written that, you know, 10 years before, but you know, the way these things work, it could get picked up years later, but I would like to see it on the screen basically. So you've had your little work with Netflix. Is there any chance we'll be seeing a Netflix adaptation? Can we get the scoop here today?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because, it's funny you say that because I have a producer friend, and basically we all have contacts in the different studios, you know, Sony, MGM, Netflix, HBO. And he just read the script for the first time on his plane back to LA, and he loved it. And he's like, man, this should be made into a show. Like, what's taken this so long? And I'm just like, I just haven't had the time to put it out there to people. You know, it's like when you're working for the man, so to speak, there's no time to do your own stuff because you're so busy, like, you know, doing other people's. But it's the short story is nothing yet. But yes, it's on the docket. There's another big project I'm doing. and it's on the docket to start pushing it heavily to try to get it greenlit. And everyone that's ever read it, you know, I'm biased, of course, because I'm the author, but every independent person that has read it has said the same thing. It's very commercially viable. It feels very much like all these kind of franchises that are out there. In fact, I just had a review of the novel come out 2 days ago where the guy said the same thing. He said it's super reminiscent of 80s horror and slashers and teenage angst. And like, this is what horror fans love. So let's do it. So I'm hoping, fingers crossed. We'll see.
And I just remembered Wishbone was the name of that dog.
Oh, Wishbone. Ah, nice.
Yeah. And then was there another one? Clueless did a headless horseman kind of skit as well.
Yeah. God, there's been so many. And, you know, obviously, oh, well, the other part I didn't mention was I'm a huge, huge, huge Tim Burton fan. And obviously he did Sleepy Hollow, the movie with Johnny Depp and Christina Ricci. So that endeared me even more so because you got my favorite director, my favorite aesthetic with my favorite story, a childhood story, and my favorite author, American literature. So it's like, I call that the film gods. All these things are pointing to the same thing. All right, you need to get off your ass and do this. You know, you need to make this project happen. So the next step after the script was the novel, for sure.
Yeah, so I'm not too sure how much you want to dive into spoiler territories for the book itself.
I don't mind. I mean, it's up to people. You know, they can turn it off at this point if they're planning on reading it. Otherwise, we can put it out there. You know, the book's been out for since October, so I don't mind.
Okay. Yeah, because it's a really fun book. Took you on a good ride. So we will put a spoiler warning here for...
Yeah.
Don't go any further, folks. If you want to go read the book, I can pick it up on Amazon on Kindle or get the physical if needs be. And we'll put the links in the show notes as well on where you can get those. So it really follows, I would say there's like two main characters primarily. There'd be Vincent and Lorraine. But you'd probably give a better blurb summary of the book before we continue.
Okay, a blurb summary of the book. It's modern day Sleepy Hollow, which, by the way, some people don't know this. It is a real town. It was formerly called Tarrytown in upstate New York on the Pocantico River, north of Manhattan, up in a place called Tappan Zee where the river swells. So it was called Tarrytown. After Washington Irving wrote this story, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, posthumously, I believe, they named it Sleepy Hollow after the character. The whole town is covered in Headless Horseman stuff. Fire trucks, police cars, the mayor's office. The school is called the Horseman, Sleepy Hollow Horseman. So that's the backdrop of this story.
Typical. Yeah, because you've been there after the fact. And
I've been there after the fact, which
this
is crazy.
Isn't in the book. This is actually everything is covered in Headless Horseman. Yeah,
everything is. Yeah, isn't, yeah. I mean,
That's the nonfiction part of the story.
That's the cool thing to me. There's a lot of nonfiction in the story. In fact, the guy who did the foreword, Jonathan Kruk, he calls himself a master storyteller, which he is. But he's one of the premier erudite scholars of that area, particularly of Washington Irving, the Hudson River Valley, Sleepy Hollow. So he's a historian and an entertainer. So I read all his books prior to finishing the novel. And so there's a lot of historical stuff that's wrapped into the novel. Even there's like the Easter eggs, like if you went down the rabbit hole of studying the area, both the facts and the fiction, the American Revolutionary War, all that stuff that happened there, all that's intertwined. And most of it's factual in the book, which kind of leads to the credence of it. Like, again, it's a modern day ghost story. So is the Headless Horseman real or is he not? That's the question. It's like saying, right, is Bigfoot real or is he not? That's the premise we're putting ourselves into, this small town Americana that has embraced it, you know, 100% embraced the story. So that's where we start. That's the backdrop of our story.
Super, yeah, because you really did take us on a journey to ask that question. Very much echoes the Legend of Sleepy Hollow with the question all the way through to the end and in the middle. And I thought I had it surmised, and then I didn't, and then I did, and then I didn't.
Yeah.
So you really kept us on a journey, particularly through the main protagonist, Vincent, and his struggles with mental health and everything like that, especially, and it's more true now in the last 2 years. I think a lot of people cooped up and everything would be quite tough for them. I think this will ring true a lot more. So it's when kind of life imitates art a little bit.
Absolutely.
So that was very good. And the characters are really lively, but I think what really ticked me off that it was actually a screenplay, and I'd only remember today when I listened to our chat back that you actually mentioned that you had the screenplay for this. So I was like, oh, wait a minute. I already knew at the back of my mind that this was a screenplay.
Right.
But what really kind of like rung the bell was the amount of, you know, pop culture references jammed into the book. And do you think, having a look at it back now, that this will help the book age well? Or do you think maybe in another 10 or 20 years, it'll be quite hard to sort of pick up the vibe? Because I really felt like it set a vibe and a scene that if you were a director or something, you'd be like, oh yeah, it needs to look or feel like this. Do you feel that might be the case?
That's a brilliant question, and I'll give you the true answer to it. This will be exclusive. Yes, and yes. The answer to that is... I probably have too many pop culture references in there. That can be a bit of a first time author mistake. And I was warned about that by my editor, who said, you maybe not want to put, there's some obscure things in here. Not everyone's going to get this. So that happens to everybody. However, I read a lot of Stephen King, arguably the best selling a horror novelist in the world, and he's always done that in his books, always. And if you read a book now from the 70s, he'll say all kinds of stuff, products that don't even exist anymore, or films, or things that we have no idea what they are unless we look it up on the internet and be like, what the fuck is he talking about here? So that's not unprecedented, but I agree with you that in modern day, in 10 years, definitely, especially today's generation, they're not gonna have time for that. They're gonna be like, what is he talking about? Who are the Kyoto brothers? Like, they're not gonna know who the Kyoto brothers are, for example. They're just not gonna know or care. I'd say part of it is, you know, as an author, you do have all these things that are very personal to you, and you want to sort of exercise the demons from your system, get it all on paper, even if it's an inside joke or inside knowledge of you and your friends. It's sort of a tome. For me, it's a tome. It's my first work. It's a major work. If I die tomorrow, I'll die happy knowing that it's been done. I got everything in there that I wanted to get in there. So I feel like it's a necessary evil, and I wouldn't have it in any other way, because in fact, I had the option, because the editor would highlight all those things and say, are you sure you want to put this in here? Maybe you just cut that out. And I think I left, if I had to guess, 70% of my stuff in there, even against her wishes. But nowadays, I mean, right now, current time, it creates a very clear picture of kind of what you're going for. So I don't know the answer to that. I guess in future I would do it less, maybe, probably. But for this novel, it felt right, and I have no regrets. I think it was good to add those things into this particular novel.
Well, that's interesting that the editor picked it up as well.
Oh, absolutely.
I should become an editor. I took way too long to read the book, though. You were like, hello, Richard, are you still there? I was like, yeah, man, I'm halfway through.
right.
I did get through it, but every time I was reading it, it was actually lots of fun. And I did notice one reference for eagle-eyed people who are well into the Jude Walco lore in the video store. It was a nice little cheeky little Easter egg. I won't spoil it for anyone. But that was fun.
Yeah, there's some good ones in there.
And then there was other stuff, as I wouldn't say I'm a student of the genre or anything, but I certainly I'm interested that I was scratching my head. I had to look it up. So that's why I was asking the question, because I was like, wonder how this will age. Like the characters, some of them, like I would say it was like the initial impression you were saying, like like painting the picture of someone, like the notably the sheriff, I thought some of the later revelations with him went against his initial character, that he was quite forward and suggestive with Vincent's mother.
I felt that
went against his character. Would you feel that there was anything like that where you would tweak it if you had maybe
back? I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. I like heroes with flaws, and I like villains with redeemable qualities. I think that's a real interesting human, a very human approach to life. You know, like the first time, like I'll tell you a little segue, a short story. When I was in high school, Bruce Hornsby, the pianist, was one of my idols. He was my idol because my mother had died when I was early. I listened to his music, The Way It Is, Mandolin Rain, all that came out. I love that guy. I still love that guy. But I had a chance to meet him at a concert at my college. At the time, I was going to St. John's University in Queens, New York. And he gave a college for a real small venue, like maybe, I don't know, less than 500 people. And I knew the promoter at the college, so I got to meet him, and he was walking out to his bus. And I was like this young seminarian, Catholic school guy, pristine and proper. I wrote him a 3-page letter because I knew I was going to meet him. And I said, "You're my idol." And he said something, you know, he pulls out a cigarette and he said something like, "Yeah, man, this fucking tour's been shit," or something like that. And he got on the bus, you know, he's like, "Nice to meet you, kid." And he grabbed the thing, got on the bus. And he's an amazing guy. I still love it. I worship the guy. He's great. That doesn't mean he's a bad person. It just means it took away my whole sense of putting him up on this pedestal that he was this perfect, you know, to my idea of what a perfect person was at the time. The man's a fucking genius. I love the guy. So that's not to detract from him. But the point of the story is I like that in characters. And I also like that I love twists with the readers. I like to fuck with them a little bit, you know? So I like when you're expecting something to happen, or you're expecting someone to act a certain way. Like, you know, here's a big plot spoiler that it's also a trigger warning or a content warning for some people. There's a character in there, Price, that has, you know, he admittedly has pedophilic tendencies in his as a younger guy. Now he's like in his 40s or whatever, but he gets busted for, you know, like looking over a fence at his neighbor's young daughter in a bikini type thing. And then he goes on. But in the current part of the story, he's like mentoring some of the young kids, and he's like donating his time and his money to the school and stuff like that. But on the other side, he's also having an affair with the married woman. So there's this dichotomy of, as this guy, is he evil? Yeah, he probably is. And he's going to pay for his sins, which is a big, you know, plot line in the whole story. He's going to pay for his sins. Yeah. But also he does have, he's trying to make amends for his past wrongs. He does have a slight little sliver of goodness in his heart too. And I think that's really interesting with characters when they're not, you know, full bore one way or the other. So I think I would do that again. I think that's a technique I'd probably use in the future for sure.
Okay. No, that's fair enough to get the insight. I was just wondering where that was maybe coming from, that people appeared one way, but then they do something, you know, a little bit not suitable for work or out of character. I was like, oh, that's not in character for that person. But
and see I was going to say that wouldn't work in the film version for sure, because you wouldn't know the backstory. You wouldn't know what other things were going on in this person's mind to make them work out of character. So that would not work in the film version. But in the novel, it does, because you get sort of the backstory of why they might have a little bit of goodness or vice versa.
Yeah, because definitely I'd like to know the difference of like what you took out or added in terms of, there was a lot of, I suppose, B and C characters that you're wondering where those stories going, and they eventually have the same sort of fate, we'll say. I don't want to spoil too much, but I think that would work very well in like a series where there's sort of like, you know, B and C subplots, and you're like, what's going on here? Yeah. But in terms of like the book, I was like, where is this story going to fit in? But it ended up being like, they're just a destination on someone's path, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's true. And I think probably, and you know, it's interesting because the things you bring up are things that they're critiques that other people have of the novel. You know, like I've had probably 10 or 15 reviews done, and both by professionals and non-professionals. And the two biggest critiques I get are, one is, you know, my writing is very descriptive, so that's a plus in that it's very visceral and you can almost see what I'm saying because I describe it so detailed.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah. Yeah, but
that's a plus, though. That I would say that's
right.
A plus.
Although some people say that's a minus because they're into getting to the point, like, you know, what's happening in the story. We don't need to know what color the fucking doorbell was, kind of thing. You know, that's.
But you actually weren't that granular, though.
Yeah,
because yeah. It's quite, just as a quick aside, like, it is quite a graphic, it's a graphic novel, but it isn't a graphic novel.
Yeah.
Right. So no, it's quite graphic. Yeah. And it was more to my own sensibilities that,
yeah,
I felt that, oh, hang on, this is what's happening in front of me, but I was actually unfazed as well. But yeah, it was like so descriptive that it was comical. And I know that's exactly what you wanted, because it is it's quite a lighthearted book. But then when the violence happens, it's like, oh, this is actually insane, over the top violence.
Right.
But yes, as you were saying.
Yeah. So I think the characters, I was going to say, the second thing that they say is too many characters or sub characters that don't sort of fit into the overall picture, I guess, or fit a lot into the picture. And that's probably a flaw. It's probably a flaw of my, again, going back to that character thing, because the main reason for the side characters are to build up or destroy the main characters, right? So they're there to like create a more robust world for the, you know, like the two friends and the bullies of Vincent. You know, Vincent has this group of kids that are sort of bullying him all the time, and his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And then he has his two best friends too, that are kind of, you know, his little rat pack. And those characters are either building up or destroying Vincent. Really, that's their main purpose. And then some characters are obviously driving the story. Like there's a psychiatrist character that's Vincent's sort of doctor and mentor, but advisor kind of guy. So he's there as a MacGuffin, as we say in the film business. He's a vehicle of the plot to get the plot from A to B. But you know, like I had a backstory for him, and I had a whole story about his house and why he got into being a doctor and why he sort of did the abusive things he does now. And a lot of that was cut out, you know, by the editor. She was like, this is too much. So I left some of it in and I cut a lot of it out as an example. So yeah, I think it'd probably be a good series, you know, because it's like I do have ideas and subplots and backstories for all these characters, and they're all interesting characters. Like, I don't think there's any characters that you're just like, that person, you know, doesn't really, who cares, you know.
Well, that's sort of what I was getting at, because it was like you're giving breadcrumbs to something that isn't there, because it isn't there, because it's on.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you can build the backstory, but for the sake of the novel, it's really focusing on like two or three people primarily. But I think that works. The side plots like work well to kind of pad out like a show.
Yeah.
To get like your 30, 45 minutes.
Right.
But that's when I was like reading it, I was like, oh, this is kind of a page turner, because I kind of want to see what happens. But you know, there isn't much room for it to go, because
yeah,
the way a book is laid out, it has to be linear. And yeah, obviously a show is linear, but yeah, you can kind of chop it a little bit.
Right,
and
right.
Every second episode, you could jump
the
timeline sort of thing. It's harder to do on a book.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But it was definitely very entertaining. So when you were converting it over from the screenplay to the novel, how much was, do you think it was more substantial, or was there more cut out, or?
I'll say this, the script served as a 90% backbone of the novel. So it's very, very close as far as plot, structure and even events. But I will say this, and writers talk about this, it was my first time experiencing this, and it was amazing. One of the main characters, I won't tell you who you know, but I won't tell the audience who, one of the main characters dies in a tragic event after she's had an argument. And after they've had an argument. And in the book, that never happened. But while I was writing it, it came to its natural conclusion out of nowhere. Like, it's sort of like, you know, like they say, what do they call that? I don't know, when the gods are writing through you as a vessel, or Washington Irving is penning through you, or whatever, that story kind of took that turn, no pun intended. That to me is the best chapter in the book, one. And two, I was really shocked. I was happy. I was like, holy shit, that character just died. And I had never planned for that. So that, I don't know. So that deviated from the script extremely. And then it changed the rest of the script, the novel after, because now that character's dead. So you have to sort of work the world around that huge event that happens. So it was really interesting, but literally what I would do is I would have the screenplay open, and I would read it, you know, I would read like a couple of pages, and then I would go to the novel and start free-flowing stream of conscious writing all the stuff that went into that. And occasionally I would just throw the script to the side and my brain would go. And then whenever I got to a natural stopping point, I would go back to the script. So it's pretty close as a roadmap.
Hmm. Okay, that's good. Yeah, because I've had for years now, and people are probably sick of me even hinting towards it, I have a story idea which doesn't go beyond probably like two paragraphs.
Uh-huh.
But it's like the world building is there. So
yeah.
I never critique anyone who actually puts anything out. I more like to explore through questions. How do you go from I have an idea, which is like, oh, cool, Sleepy Hollow, new Sleepy Hollow, and then suddenly it's, you know, a 350-page book. I think the word we're looking for there is like, how do you become the conduit to put it onto the page?
Yeah. Wow, man, that's a deep question. I would say, well, for me, you know, I engineered it over a long period of time. Let's call it a decade for conciseness point, because I originally wrote the script at least 10 years ago before the novel came out. So to me, the first part is having an idea, which a lot of people have, like you said, just like yourself, but it's getting to the next step is the hard part. So that part is the structure, the character, and the arcs and the subplots. So for that, you know, there's people that have made formulas out of this, which is where I started. So Joseph Campbell, right? That he's a the hero's journey and all that kind of stuff.
It's on the Kindle, ready to go.
Yeah. So, right. So Joseph Campbell, you know, Save the Cat, The Hero's Journey, those kinds of books tell you, sort of teach you the basics. They sort of draw back the curtain, you know, if you use the Wizard of Oz metaphor, they draw back the curtain so you can see how the machine works. Once you understand the, you know, the story arc, which is not that difficult because you've seen it your whole life, you know, you've been being told stories since you were a baby. So it's not like you don't understand it. It's just like you don't have a conscious grasp of it until you look behind the curtain. Once you know that, then it's the fun part. Then it's, you know, just letting the creative juices flow, knowing you have to reach a certain plot arc. Some people are very meticulous about it. Like, you know, they're like the accountant type mindset, you know, very tedious, meticulous type of people, organized. And they do cue cards and plot points and characters, and they set it up on a big board and they do that kind of thing. That's a certain type of person. I'm the opposite, where I don't want to know any of that stuff, because I like the element of surprise for myself. So I kind of do more stream of consciousness, like I said, and then a character dies out of nowhere that I wasn't expecting. So that's a different, completely different. No one's better than the other. It's just some people do one way, some people do the other way. Even in novel writers, you know, now that I'm part of the writing community, I talk to a lot of authors. I I see chats and reviews and Twitters and all these kind of things. And it's a very similar for both screenwriters and novel writers, a very similar thing. So then I feel once that happens, okay, that's the second step, understanding story structure, arcs and stuff. Then you start to write it down, you know, and you sort of exercise the demons, as I say. And then the next phase after that is a very difficult part of, you know, plot holes and things that just don't make sense. Even to me, that happened. Every author, it happens to, like, where you're like, how in the hell is this going to happen if this is happening, or if this is happening, or that's not believable. So that's the hard part of, like, there's the easy way to just sit, you know, make it fairy tale and everything happens because who the fuck cares? But still, if it takes place in the real world, and for me, like you said, like you were talking about, you alluded to in the beginning of the conversation, you thought you had it, and then you were like, oh no, I don't. And then you go back. That had to be engineered. That was super hard because I was like, okay, if this character is over here doing this thing and this person just died, or they told this person, or they were seen over there, then how am I going to make it logical that all this stuff is happening and still believable that there's a big question mark as to...
No, because I'd love to spoil it, but it wouldn't be fair.
I know.
On the audience, but maybe we can have the after discussion.
The after discussion.
Because there's definitely a little bit for the after discussion, because I'm dying a few questions more that can't be on air. We have to keep the suspense.
Do it.
Like, basically, I think my idea have you seen the trailers for, like, the new movie by Robert Eggers for The Northman?
I haven't seen that one. No, I'll check it out though.
It looks like ancient, I was going to say ancient Egypt, the Vikings.
Okay, yeah.
So it's kind of like, you know, a period piece.
Mm-hmm.
So mine would be a Halloween tale set in ancient Ireland.
Sweet. And that sounds awesome.
That's about all I'd say. And like, that's pretty much the extent of my idea. there's a little bit more to it. Actually, maybe I'll put it out in the ether, because I actually don't care if someone steals this, because I want it done.
Yeah.
It'd be a Halloween story. So you know yourself with Halloween. It's an ancient Irish festival, Samhain, above all else. And I won't take anyone else's answer for that. It's Irish.
It's true. It's the truth, though.
So it's the point at which the night overtakes the day. So it's the thinning of the veil. It's a harvest festival. So the whole thing would sort of be centered around Halloween, that there's like an ancient order of ghoul hunters, we'll say. So the thinning of the veil, like when all the spookies come out.
Yeah.
That there'd be like a lineage. And then one day, maybe an old man who has a daughter or son who's going to be next in line actually fails on his mission and he dies and the ghosts come out or something. That's kind of the story that I was thinking, but I have fucking nothing besides the pitch.
Well, see, that's like super in my world building too, because, you know, the horseman has the Tritum of the Hallows, which is obviously something I invented, but it's like the 3 days when the dead can walk with the living, you know, which is Samhain, Halloween, All Hallows Eve, All Saints Day, whatever you want to call it, All Souls Day. So it's the same thinning of the veil. It's the same time period. Like you, in my story, I have the, you know, it's sort of this, in me, it's kind of like Stephen King's It, you know, like in It, there's a 20, every 23 years, this sort of evil descends upon this town to, you know, do whatever it's going to do. And mine is sort of based on the waxing and waning of the moon, but it's a similar thing where, you know, the town's got to cleanse itself in one way or the other. Yours is a great story. I mean, God, I would watch the shit out of that. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, I was speaking to guys a few years ago who've gone dark, but we were in talks to get them maybe to ghostwrite it, but.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll have to talk about that maybe somewhere down the road. That's a collaborative.
No, it's definitely in the back burner. As pretty much, I think I'm like 20 years younger than you, so I think maybe on the same trajectory. I'm still working for the man, and I don't have the time to be putting fingers to the keyboard. So it's like, oh man, because I have a little draft in Google Docs somewhere that's just like diarrhea on the page.
That's how it starts. Ideas.
I know.
That's how it starts.
Yeah, it's an interesting process. That's why I wanted to ask you just how, because you've been producing, directing, writing screenplays, and now you've done the novel. So it's very impressive overall. And it's a really, really fun book. I would say it's pulpy, it's fun, it's fast paced.
Yeah.
I think anyone who just like is into horror should definitely like pick it up. And I think it's fairly cheap on Amazon as well.
Yeah.
For people to pick up.
Super cheap. Yeah.
And given that I think it really stands on its own by itself. Yeah. Do you think you could have just done, you know, big spooky and kids in a town that could have been in Atlanta or anything like that? Or was there any particular reason why you wanted this to be a love letter? Or was it just for the recognition of the Unhallowed Horseman? Or was any particular reason?
Yeah, I mean, you mean as far as where the story takes place?
Yeah, because you're, I suppose, borrowing a character for that and a place for that. But in terms of if you just did that as your own story and just changed the place name and...
Oh, I see. Yeah.
It would have stood for by itself.
For me, it's absolutely a love letter, 100%. I admit that in all my writings and interviews. But it's more than that, because this character in my heart and many Americans' hearts, it's so endearing, if you will, even though it's a scary character, just like Krampus is a scary character, but it's endearing to people of that culture. Same with the Headless Horseman. And then America is obviously, we all know this as far as, not counting the Native Americans, but as far as, an English colony, America is not that old. So we don't have a lot of scary places in America, there's not a lot of, there's a handful of things that are a couple hundred years old. So we have ghost stories and whatnot, but this is really the birth, Washington Irving's story is really the birth of the American horror tale. So I feel culturally that, they call him the grandfather of American literature too. I feel culturally that it just holds such a special place in America. Then, like you said, you've seen this before a million times. The Northeast rustic small town, that's what every small town and every American horror movie is supposed to be.
And I love it. And I want to go there for Halloween at some stage, because it's more Halloween than Irish Halloween. It's like Halloween.
Exponential Halloween. Exactly. So once you go to the Northeast part of America, the homes are older. You got Salem where the witch trials happened. It's all in the general sort of Northeast area. There's just more culture there. It just feels creepier. You're used to seeing it, all the, Freddy Krueger and Jason movies and Halloween and all these things have portrayed it. When we make movies for American audience, we don't make, in general, if the demographic is all of America, then we don't want it to be specifically LA. We want it to be middle America, which, Northeast America with their Victorian homes and four seasons and all that, snow and fall and all that, is the epitome of Norman Rockwell's sort of picture painting of America. So that's why it's a good backdrop. Now, I wrote that not knowing, like I've mentioned before, I didn't know any of that when I was writing the script, when I was writing the script. And then I went to visit Terrytown and was shocked that it was all exactly how I pictured it in my head. And I got this overwhelming sense of like, okay, this is really meant to be. Like, this is really whatever you want to call it, something outside of myself speaking to this story. Like, it has to take place here. now. And in fact, if I could shoot it and it was viable from a production standpoint and budget standpoint, I would shoot it in that actual town. I would, or at least close, as close to it as I could. But that's not always viable. Sometimes that's a backlot in LA, you know. but yeah, just everything about that town, the history, the area, and you know, when you go there, there's lots of videos on YouTube actually of people visiting now. You can walk over the place where the actual bridge used to be, the covered bridge. That you can go to Washington Irving's house. You can go to Lyndhurst Mansion out there. You know, all these things. The church that's on the back cover of my book is in Sleepy Hollow. It's the old Dutch church in Sleepy Hollow Cemetery where Washington Irving is born. Buried. And the original.
He could have been born there too.
He could have been born there too. The inspiration for Katrina Van Tassel, I forget her real name, it's something Van Tassel, who's also in my story as Lady Van Tassel. All those people are real people. You know, all those, that culture is really there. Those events, the nonfiction events actually happen there. So there, it's just, it's perfect. You know, like I have no need to reinvent the wheel when such perfection already exists in the real world, I guess.
Very humble. No, of course. No, I think that's a good enough preview for anyone. I think we've titillated them long enough with that. What is next on the list then? Because you're a very busy man from what you've been filling us in. I wonder what will happen in the next 4 years.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully it's not that long until our next go-round. yeah, so, wow, I got a lot. So, something completely out of left field for me. My business partner, I have a company called Blue Falcon Productions. My business partner was a Marine in Fallujah, Iraq in 2006 and 2007. So he and all his, he belonged to this platoon, Alpha Company 124 3rd Platoon. That's mumbo jumbo for a group of guys that were in Iraq during a very particular set of historical events that changed the course of counterinsurgency for American military. So right now we're interviewing everybody in his company. There were some key events that happened, some killed in action, wounded in action. There's some mysterious characters. We're interviewing Iraqi nationals. We're building a docuseries on that. It's super involved. It's over 50 people that we have to interview. So again, that's totally outside the realm for me. I'm fiction guy. I'm fictional narrative horror guy, you know, so I'm not docu guy. But it just, it's a very personal thing for my business partner, and it all started to come together, and now it's come to a head. And we actually, we pitched it to HBO a couple of weeks ago. They ended up saying they really loved it, but they don't have the slate for it right now. But they said come back to them. But that's a huge project. And then I'm writing... I'm under NDA, so I can't talk about who this is, but I can just tease it and tell you I'm writing an authorized biography of some iconic 80s filmmakers, basically, that have put together some really cult classic stuff, and I'm working with them on their biography that I'm going to write. So that's like... I think I probably went blue here.
You're all good.
So that again involves hours and hours and hours of interviews, and then me eventually and research, and then eventually writing that biography. So I'm guessing it'll be 6 months of research. So what is it, May? So maybe by the end of the year, I'm done with the research, and then probably another half a year. So maybe in a year's time, I'm ready to publish that book. Probably I would, if I had to guess, just because it's 40 years of pretty high profile people in the business. So there's a lot of interesting stories and stuff.
Might have to put you on the slate. So before HBO for that one,
when
it comes out.
Yeah. It's going to be great. I'm super excited. Like that one, I'm overjoyed because they're friends of mine and they're colleagues, but I'm also fans of theirs too. So it's like, and I'm fans. It's like for me, for my generation, for my age, it's like the perfect pop culture thing. So I'm super excited every time I talk. And they're very they're giving me all the details because I'm under NDA, so I can't talk about it. But they can talk freely to me. So I'm getting like all these nuggets of like, holy shit, that's incredible kind of stuff, you know. Really cool stuff.
Yeah, it's a conversation for another day, but it's definitely the case where all things 80s is like coming home to roost from like,
yeah,
people reviving it in terms of video games and everything. Like everything's kind of reached maturity where the people who grew up with them are making them now.
Yeah, exactly. That's such a good point.
So because there's it's this other crowd, Creator VC, they've done like 80s horror doc and 80s sci-fi doc, and I don't know, have you come across those? Maybe you have.
I don't think I have, but I'd love to watch them. I watched the there's a Netflix series called The Movies That Made Us. Have you seen that?
I have not seen that.
It's really good. Really good. So it's like all the you know, like Back to the Future, Ghostbusters, RoboCop, all those 80s, primarily 80s movies, but it's the behind the scenes and interviews with the actual people sort of wrapped up nicely in an hour long, an hour per movie, you know, so like Ghostbusters is an hour long kind of thing. It's really good. It's insightful because you get to hear some of the dirt, Hollywood dirt on some of those projects that you would have never known as the general public.
Okay, I think that just about wraps it up. I know we could chat for another 5 years.
We could.
In between, there's so much to talk about, but I don't want to give too much away about the book. I'm dying to ask you a few questions after. So if you want to find out what I'm asking Jude, you're not going to hear it. Just read the book and you'll pretty much get what I was teasing at during the thing. So Jude, an absolute pleasure again to have you on. It's always fun talking to you now because it's been twice. I can say always.
That's two right. For two. That's good. It's good, so, percentage.
I know. So where can people find you online if they want to reach out? I know you'd be keen to hear some feedback.
Yeah, I would love it. Actually, and you know, I've mentioned this before, I'm super open to good, bad, or indifferent critiques on my work, whether it's my films or my novels. So please reach out to me. I'm pretty much, if you just look up Jude S. Walko, middle initial S is in Stephen Walko, WALKO. I'm on all social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, also Goodreads. If you do read the novel, please give it I'm not telling you to give it a good review. It could an honest review on Goodreads or Amazon. That really helps just to have more people weighing in on it, good, bad, or indifferent. It helps a lot. And you can reach out to me if you read the novel and you have questions. I'm pretty responsive on my social media, so reach out to me and then we can have a chat. So feel free, just Jude S. Walko across the board, pretty much on everything.
Super. We'll add a few of those to the show notes and the few other links that we mentioned, like to buying the book on Amazon and the behind the scenes for the incantation. So that thus concludes yet another episode of the Bizarrecast. You thought maybe you'd get a year without the Bizarrecast audience, but no, stay subscribed. we pulled it out of the bag.
Such a pleasure, by the way. Thank you so much for having me.
Exactly. No, it's all good. I was just waiting for the right guest.
Thank you.
So until next time, folks, you can follow on Twitter at the Bizarrecast or at the Fear Merchant. And any feedback from myself, you can email me or leave a voice note on Anchor, the new host of the show. So until next time, take care, stay spooky, and we'll see you in the next episode. And it will be sooner than the next 4 months. Take care.
Take care.
End of line.